Good morning. I'm back again. I was just thinking that for many years I have been doing something called Coffee and Concepts, and I do it on my Patreon, where we all get a coffee and we talk about some concept. So I guess this new thing that I'm doing, where I sit down in the morning and talk about something that's on my mind, is an extension of that. So this is Coffee and Concepts. Hello, welcome. I promised in the last video that I would talk about enjoyment and how we get our enjoyment from life. And I want to talk a little bit about the difference between what we can call ideological enjoyment and emancipatory enjoyment. So I'm going to use, again, kind of like some technical terms, but I'll explain them all, and I'm going to give plenty of examples to, I think, illustrate what I'm trying to say. So we'll start with the idea of enjoyment. I'm actually going to use the term jouissance. So we're going to talk about ideological jouissance and emancipatory jouissance. And the reason why I'm using the term jouissance, it's a French term, and it's a technical term in continental philosophy that describes a type of enjoyment. Now, some theorists, someone like Todd McGowan, he just uses enjoyment, and I understand why. He thinks sometimes these technical terms are more unhelpful than they are helpful. But I want to use the term because there's something missing in the word enjoyment that jouissance captures. Enjoyment connotes in English that you're getting some sort of pleasure from something. And there can be a distinction made between pleasure and enjoyment that's important. Pleasure might be what I get out of drinking this coffee. And enjoyment is what I get out of thinking about drinking the coffee, right? So you enjoy the lead up to Christmas and you get pleasure out of opening the presents. But jouissance also captures something, I think, much kind of deeper. Jouissance brings together at least three different ideas. One is sexuality. So jouissance is about orgasm in French. So there's a sexual dimension. And when you're thinking about the sexual dimension in terms of psychoanalysis, a helpful way to think about it is a type of non-utility enjoyment. So for example, you can eat food in order to get energy and to feed your body and to feel less tired. So the food has a utility. But if you go to another extreme and you think about a tasting menu, where almost everything about a tasting menu is not about utility, it's about taste. Now, you can even go further than that and think about wine tasting, where you don't even drink the wine. So you might, for utilitarian reasons, drink wine to relax because you want to feel a little bit tipsy, you want to kind of feel a little bit less repressed. Whatever it is, there's certain utility to drinking wine. But when you're wine tasting, you're getting rid of that utility and you're concentrating purely on this sensuality. So you can think about sexuality in terms of sensuality like that. So jouissance captures that a type of enjoyment that has a sensual, non-utilitarian value to us. Second, jouissance captures the notion of a suffering. So it's not all about something that's pleasurable. Jouissance can be experienced as anxiety. And a good way of thinking about this, which I'm going to come back to maybe a couple of times in this short talk, is that you might, for example, scroll on Twitter and read people who disagree with you and whose positions you find offensive and destructive and whatever, right? And you find yourself angry, you find yourself anxious, but you're also lured by it, you're caught into it, you're grasped by it, right? So there is a type of enjoyment, but the enjoyment isn't experienced as enjoyment, it's experienced as suffering. And so jouissance captures that. Jouissance can be like being on a roller coaster and you're going over the edge and you feel anxious and you're going, why am I doing this? And you're terrified, but you're doing the roller coaster because you're getting something out of it. So jouissance doesn't just mean enjoyment, pleasure. It means a pleasure also in suffering. And it has a sensual dimension. So that's why I want to use the term jouissance, because I think it's a richer term. So then if I'm going to start by talking about ideological jouissance, then I have to give a brief definition of ideology. Todd McGowan actually has a really good video on that on his YouTube channel, so I'd recommend you go and watch it. It's only 15 or 20 minutes long, and I think it gives a really brilliant short description of what ideology, its beginnings, the early use of that term, through into Marx and beyond into people like Zizek and then McGowan's own thoughts on it. So I'm just going to give a very brief definition. And you can say that ideology at its core always is a kind of takes a contingent historical way of looking at the world and renders it eternal, says that's the way things should be. So whether it's slavery or feudalism or capitalism or whatever it is, or some, you know, not just economic system, some political system or some religion, it says this is the truth. And this reflects human nature, or it reflects the will of God, or it reflects reason itself. So you take something that grew up, has a history, has a genealogy, and you render it kind of eternal and the truth. But then connected to that is ideology also has to cover over its antagonisms, the things that prevent the ideology from, so within feudalism, for example, all of the conflicts and the antagonisms within feudalism have to be given a justification. In slavery, the justification is might is right. In feudalism, the justification is often more ideological. This is God's will. This is the nature of the hierarchy of the system, the way things are placed in a certain kind of order. And capitalism has its justifications as well, right? So the different systems justify their position as being the way things are, the way they should be. And all of the antagonisms that are generated within these systems have to be explained away as contingent problems that can be sorted out. So in contemporary society, we may see homelessness, for example, as a contingent problem that can be sorted out within the system, rather than potentially a symptom of the system, i.e. the site that tells you the truth of the system itself. So it's like a cancer that can be cut out, rather than, as I say, a symptom that is the visible manifestation of a problem within the social body. So ideology has its, you have a belief, you have a set of, this is the way the world is. And in America, for example, you know, you have Republican and Democrats kind of views of the world. And then you have some reason why you're not able to fully actualize the ideological vision. And this then becomes down to having an enemy, right? So ideology is inherently connected with scapegoating mechanisms. You need a reason for why it's not working, so you can point to some group and say, if only we could get rid of them, then everything would be fine, right? So that's a scapegoat. Now, the next term, I think there's going to be three technical terms here: jouissance, ideology, and what's called objet petit A, right? Small object A. And I might just talk about object A, but it's objet petit A is the technical term. One of the real contributions of Slavoj Žižek's work in political theory was to show that ideology requires an objet petit A, right? And that's how it functions. And this is a term that comes from Lacan, and it's Lacan's greatest contribution to the intellectual field, in his own thoughts as well, is this notion of objet petit A. It's a very difficult notion. I'm just going to give again a very brief summary of what it means in context of what I'm talking about. Please bear with me. Once I've got all of these technical terms out of the way, we'll get to some examples and then hopefully something that you can apply to your life. So objet putia is often described as the object cause of desire. So there are objects that you desire. You might desire a meal, you might desire to go out with friends, watch a movie. So there's things that you desire. But there's also what causes that desire, what evokes that desire. And you can think about it in a very simple sense of in which when you fall out of love, when you lose somebody you love, you don't just lose an object that you desire, something that you desire. You can lose the ability to desire anything, right? So it's not just that there's 10 things in the world that you desire and then you've lost one, right? You can lose things that you desire all the time, but whenever you lose this person that you love, what you might experience is the loss of desire as such. You no longer desire any of the other things that once gave you pleasure. You haven't lost them, right? Maybe you enjoyed nature, going out, walking in forests, and suddenly you don't enjoy that. It hasn't been taken away from you, but the object cause has been taken away from you, the thing that caused this to be desirable. Now, what Zizek shows, I think very, very profoundly, especially in his book, The Sublime Object of Ideology, is that ideology requires an object A. So ideology is a system. You go like, this is the way the world should be, whether it's progressivism or conservatism, whatever. You've got an idea of the way the world should be. You have then some antagonisms. So you have an enemy, a scapegoat, that is the reason why your world is not an organic whole. And that exception, that problem, that is your object A. Now, I'm going to use a few examples. So in fascism, it's easiest to see. We can say, well, the object A of the fascist is the figure of the Jew. So the fascist has a vision of an organic society where everything works together for the good. The folk all work together selflessly for one another. Industry, government, the workers, all kind of in this kind of harmonious, non-technological worldview, right? So a technological worldview being a worldview which reduces people to machines, mechanisms, right? So if you read Mein Kampf, Hitler is always talking about this organic whole, and then he talks about a virus, right? Some exception that is stopping the system from working as a whole, and it is this figure of the Jew. Now, it's not concrete empirical Jews, so the Nazis would attack individual Jews, right? But because you'll always find in any group people you can attack, right? So if you've got this idea of the Jews are the ones who are in control of everything and they have political power and govern, they've got power in terms of financial institutions and all of these ideas, well, of course you're going to be able to find individuals to attack. The figure of the Jew is not the empirical Jewish community. It's this phantasmic image that is required in order to sustain the ideological edifice. And it sustains the ideological edifice precisely by making it desirable, because you go, oh, it's not really possible, right? That, you know, it's not possible because of this community. We get rid of them and everything will be great. Well, the truth is, if you got rid of that community, everything wouldn't be great. You'd realize that that's just a symptom of something that is a problem within the system itself. Hegel calls this the beautiful soul, right? The beautiful soul is when you see yourself as innocent and good, and your community as being pure, and then the evil out there. You see this obviously with kids who think they're, say, a monster under the bed. They don't realize the monster is within them. They're going through the phase of the beautiful soul. They are innocent and they are good. Therefore, they have to project all of anything, any conflicts and traumas that are within them out into the world, into a monster under the bed or something hiding in the cupboard. And part of growing is, and this doesn't happen in psychosis, the psychotic subject, but what you have to try to do is integrate that into yourself. Otherwise, it will continue to appear in the real. And, you know, if you have psychotic symptoms, then you struggle with, you suffer from things occurring in the real. You know, you really do see monsters or angels and demons and stuff like that, that you haven't been able to bring that into yourself. Okay, so within fascism, the figure of the Jew is the figure of jouissance. Why? Because they are feared, they're hated, it causes anxiety, but it causes deep pleasure, deep enjoyment. You've got an enemy that explains why the system isn't working, that means you don't have to look at the deeper issues within the system. You have this phantasmic object, they are the object cause of desire. If you got rid of that community, you wouldn't be able to desire what you have, because what you have wouldn't work, right? It would collapse in on itself. And so the figure of the Jew is the object A, which is the cause of your desire, and the exception that you attack. And that is, you think that the object A is what's preventing you from achieving your vision, but it actually sustains your vision. It's the very thing that sustains your vision. I want to give a few more examples. So for progressives, it is often the figure of the Republican, right? Again, it's not about individual Republicans. There's lots of individual Republicans who are probably idiots, et cetera, and vice versa in every community. But it's the figure of the Republican that you find empirical Republicans that you can attack, but you libidinally need this figure, this abstract, speculative figure. They are the object cause, and you get your jouissance from attacking them. For conservatives, it can be the woke millennial, right? That is the object A. They get profound enjoyment from attacking this kind of woke millennial type. And although there are woke millennials who are, again, idiots, right? It's not the empirical individuals. It's you require the speculative ideal of the woke millennial as the very means by which you continue to enjoy the ideological edifice that you affirm. Another example would be in reality TV. I've talked about this before, but not in relation to Object A. But what is the Object A for people who watch reality TV? Well, it is the figure of the non-ironic viewer, right? That your enjoyment is by imagining that there is someone who watches this reality TV show for real, even if it's the characters in the show itself. Because that's often the case, is that you watch a reality TV show with the imagination that the people who are in the reality TV show aren't in on the joke, don't realize that this is ridiculous. When often, I think, I don't know much about reality TV, but some reality TV shows, the people who are in it are working on a script, right? They know that this is ridiculous looking. They play this part in order to make money. And how do they make money? Well, they make money because they embody the object A, the non-ironic participant, viewer or participant. And by the audience having that object A, which is really the source of their jouissance, they're able to watch. And because they watch, those people make a shit ton of money, right? But even in terms of a relationship, perhaps you always find yourself going out with people who betray you. And there are lots of people in the world who will betray you. But maybe you kind of find this pattern and you realize, oh, there's something about the figure of a betrayer, of being betrayed, of someone who is standoffish and cool to me. That is my object A. It allows me to keep fantasizing about a perfect relationship while always being in an imperfect relationship. And strangely, that's where you get your jouissance from. Now, I'm talking about this because this is happening behind our backs. Mostly we are not aware of our jouissance. We're just kind of getting on with life. We don't realize that central to what we are as subjects is that we extract enjoyment from our being in the world. And this ideological enjoyment, which you see all the time on social media, is a reactionary enjoyment. It's an enjoyment that creates scapegoats, creates enemies, creates social fragmentation, breaks the social bond, and it's incredibly dangerous. So what is the alternative? I'm going to talk about this more on my Patreon, by the way. If you enjoy listening to this or you want to support me, please do consider going onto my Patreon. And there's also discussions and conversations we have on these subjects. Plug over. Emancipatory jouissance is the enjoyment that you get out of exposing this structure, out of moving beyond the beautiful soul, of engaging in self-critique, and you never get rid of Object A. So it's not about getting rid of that, right? Because that's always a mistake, is to go, oh, we can somehow live without, we can embrace reality without Object A, without the object cause of desire. We always have object causes of desire, but the emancipatory enjoyment involves what can be called traversing the fantasy, which is realizing the role that plays, seeing through it, right? Kind of realizing that the kind of people that annoy you are actually part of the very system that you're part of. So they can still annoy you, right? You can still dislike either the woke millennial or the Republican from Arkansas or whatever it is, or the non-ironic viewer of reality TV, right? We have the people who bug us, but also then realizing, oh, they're part of the same system. I can't split the world into goodies and baddies. In anthropology, it's called kind of dual organization systems, or it's not the yin and yang. The world can be split into two. It's like this is a certain, that again, coming back to the homelessness thing, is homelessness isn't necessarily a problem to be solved, but a solution to a problem. There's a problem within society that creates certain kind of antagonisms that's solved by having a homeless population that can be policed, that can be imprisoned, that can be managed. And actually, if you want to get rid of that solution, you have to get rid of the problem that's operating more deeply within society. You can get your jouissance from that. I'm going to tentatively give another example of this just in the realm of jokes. But this is difficult because jokes are very complex, it's very murky. But you can talk about jokes that ridicule and attack some other, right? And jokes that implicate you in the attack of the other. The first I would call reactionary jokes, and the second emancipatory jokes. Now that doesn't in any way mean that jokes can't be offensive. If you go into any bar in Northern Ireland and you talk to people, you can only become friends with them when they tell you an offensive joke about being a Protestant or being a Catholic. You know, in the old days during the Troubles, one of the ways to break down difference and create a social bond was precisely through sharing offensive jokes with the person that you are attacking, right? And the way that works is if you tell an offensive joke, say, you know, in Northern Ireland, is a joke about Protestants or something to a Protestant. Part of the joke is you're implicating yourself as I'm an offensive sectarian person, right? So by telling the joke, you're not only, you know, making a joke about a stereotype, you're making the joke about you being the type of person who is so offensive and sectarian that you would make a joke about stereotypes, right? So, but you're implicated in the enjoyment, right? So always emancipatory enjoyment is about a type of critique that doesn't split the world into goodies and baddies, does not scapegoat, does not have an ideological edifice and then have some exception that you attack, which really is what generates your jouissance. So what does all this mean? Well, in concrete terms, it's always important for us to ask ourselves, how do I get my jouissance? Look at what you do. Don't listen to what you say. Because, in fact, the first thing you think, if you say, well, I don't get my enjoyment from X, that's often a hint that you do. In analysis, you watch out for the rejection, right? In analysis, you watch out for the person who says, I had a dream and it definitely wasn't about my mother, right? You go, I didn't even say it was, right? So the fact that you're saying it definitely wasn't about my mother, right, might mean it's about your mother. So if you're listening to your consciousness, listening to what you immediately say isn't the case, and then ask yourself whether the opposite's true. But also look at what you do. How do you act online? What kind of ways do you talk to your friends? And, you know, just begin to look at your own way of extracting jouissance from the world. And, you know, in just that act, not even trying to change anything, just the act, radical grace. Grace means you don't have to do anything. All you do is create a space where you can see yourself and potentially see something that you wouldn't want to see, right? So that radical space of coming, becoming aware of your jouissance is enough to change it. So this isn't about changing from ideological jouissance to emancipatory jouissance. It's a more complicated idea. It's the idea that simply becoming aware of your jouissance changes your relationship to it. You know, you can make an argument that all jouissance at its core is emancipatory once you become aware of it or able to symbolize it or able to understand it. So, okay, I'm just going to go over what we've covered. I hope it's clear. As I say, this is non-scripted. It's just a conversation. If you like these, please do let me know so that I'll do more. We looked at how do we get enjoyment or jouissance out of life. There's the ideological jouissance, which has an enemy. The enemy is we think we hate, but we actually really don't. We love, right? We get something out of that anxiety, that hatred, essential. It's an enjoyment, right? And that also means that you need that group, because that group might actually, you know, be not great, right? But you need them. You actually need them because they provide you with your jouissance. Emancipatory jouissance is where you realize that the group you're attacking, even if it's a group that's not great, is part of a wider system that you participate in. And it's about trying to see that and understand it and work out what those deeper issues are. And in doing that, it's a productive type of enjoyment. Okay, so there you go. I will hopefully be back in a few days to talk about something else. The next thing I want to talk about, I think, is contradiction. I did a podcast the other day, which gets released today, the first part and the second part in 2 weeks. And it was quite interesting. I talked to an analytic philosopher, so it got a bit heated by the end of the second episode, but it was a very enjoyable back and forth. But one of the things that he was pushing back on is this idea of contradiction. And so I want to talk about what contradiction means, different ways in which we can understand it, and what I mean by contradiction, especially because I'm developing something called Church of the Contradiction. All right, have a great day. Bye-bye.